Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're on Team Human, Conscious Intervention in the Machine, a chance to consider the questions vexing us all in our effort to rehumanize a world hell-bent on extinction, acknowledge the gaps in our thinking, and figure out a better story for ourselves together. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you're on Team Human. Playing for Team Human today, it's Team Human. I'll be responding to questions and comments submitted by Team Human members through our Discord server. It's a test drive of what we hope will soon be a live-streamed call-in style show. So, here we go. Thanks for doing this. This is an experiment. So, yes, you are on Team Human, and we are prototyping a new format for our version of a call-in show that will maybe include more people by being live streamed on YouTube and LinkedIn simultaneously and offer everybody, with of course you guys getting preference, but everyone will be offered the opportunity to participate through the comments sections. So they can ask questions and make comments that are then selected and read live by Josh and Luke. So today we're going to do it with our Team Human community only here on Discord. So what we've been doing is collecting posts from the questions channel, but you can also ask new questions, bring up new ideas, or comment on the show in progress from the Discord chat on this page. All right, so that's sort of the way it's going to work. And then maybe afterwards we can open up the stage again and go old school. But this is a different thing from Kibitz Room, right? This is not the super thing that we're all entitled to as Team Human members to engage live in the Kibitz Room. This is like a version, test version for a new kind of a show that would include the whole world. So with that, let me take a moment to bring us all into the same space, or at least bring you into my space by sharing a bit of where I am right now. It's just been a rough patch. I mean, everybody, I feel like, having a rough patch. I've been in a rough patch lately, both personally as I deal with a family illness and in the macro world as I continue to try to process everything that's going on, from climate change and Middle East violence to impending authoritarianism. You know, I start I've gotten a little catastrophic in some of my thinking late at night, where instead of the usual catastrophic thinking about how do I prevent us from descending into authoritarianism, I'm already asking myself things like, well, how does a society come out of authoritarianism? In other words, part of me has assumed that this is happening or has happened and wondering how do we kind of dig ourselves out of it? What I'm concluding is I'm trying to stay even more and more moment-based, more and more invested in whatever moment is actually happening. I gave a talk last week at a conference on social justice and media, and the talk was called From the Movement to the Moment. Got it? From the Movement to the Moment, Tactical Media in the Present Tense. And I'm going to talk about it more in a monologue next week, but there was something about it I wanted to share now. The gist of it is that, you know, the techno-solutionism is kind of, for me, is a 20th century tactic, you know, where we're doing something for something else. We're going to build this to solve that. And we're going to build this thing by getting all these rare earth metals and finding all this labor and doing all this damage, but we're going to end up with this thing, with this tech that's really going to solve something. It's going to do some great thing. And it's all part of that same Aristotelian narrative that I've been talking about for years, kind of this ends justifies the means, journey up the hill to the climax, and whatever things have to happen along the way are going to have to happen. Or we've spoken about this a lot, this tendency we have as social justice pioneers and activists to change people, right? How are we going to get people to do this? How are we going to get them to do that? And all of this, both of this, the techno-solutionism, Aristotelian thinking, this cause and effect, how do we get people to, it takes us out of our real-time reality. And it's disempowering because it ends up negating our actual impact right now. The way we're actually going to, the way we're moving, not the thing that we think we're solving, but the way in which we are moving is maybe the greatest impact we have on the world. So, you know, when we say, oh, I want to come up with this great high-tech renewable energy vehicle, you know, if you don't look at the immediate externalized impacts, the slavery and the resource depletion, then you're not really doing it. We are holding on to our vision, an abstracted vision. And it's the same when we try to like solve a global problem from afar, like the great example of the Gates Foundation in all of their genius deciding to give mosquito nets to all these places in Africa that ended up using the mosquito nets as fish nets and poisoning their rivers. It's like, oh, that's what happens when you solve from afar rather than from where you are. And what I've been realizing, it's also sort of relevant in one's real life. You know, when I have a family member who's in distress or having a problem, my first response is that very 20th century, maybe it's a white male response of how do I fix this? What do I do? Who do I call? What do I buy? How do I, you know? And yeah, that's great and that's sweet, but a lot of times you can't. You can't solve it. You can't figure out how to fix it. You can't really, really do anything. And rather than continue to search blindly and alone for a solution to whatever the problem might be, you know, to help in some way, to figure out what do I do, that overwhelming sense of responsibility for somehow solving the problem is probably better replaced with not doing something. With bearing witness and being genuinely present, with learning how to, it's harder. I mean, I guess what I'm thinking is so much, at least my own tendency to try to solve problems, to try to figure out what's the answer to this thing, is a way of avoiding actually bearing witness and experiencing the thing. You know, it's a way to disconnect from what is happening. Oh, you know, the Middle East. Okay, so we got to negotiate with this or get them to do that or say that, as if anyone's even going to listen, you know, rather than just being present and going, oh my gosh, what is this? How do I metabolize this? You know, it's, you know, Mushan was talking about it in last week's episode, how he said, your empathy is killing us. And it's counterintuitive. But what he meant was that empathy can be targeted and directed. Oh, I see the pain. So now I'm going to do this. Now I'm going to fight that. Now I'm going to condemn this. Now I'm going to, that's empathy. And it's, it instead of letting your empathy take you into a direct long-term action to solve, if it can bypass compassion, which is maybe more important, because when you move into a state of compassion, which is scary and hard and difficult, you're actually, now I'm going to start processing what's actually happening, bearing witness, being present in real time. You end up, your solution set might look different. It might start to look much more immediate. You know, how it's as simple as, like, how does the impact of capitalism, well, yeah, it can make me want to develop an alternative currency and build a credit union and do all those things, fine, but how does it change the way I engage with the other people in my life right now? You know, what's the capitalist mindset? How do I unwind that? And you don't need funding for that. You know, you don't need that shift happens right. It starts right in your body, in the way you look at, what do I need in my life? How am I going about things? Who am I, you know, back to my borrow a drill, who am I asking for favors? What am I doing for other people? It can start really, 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 really small. So that's sort of where my shift is going right now, is towards an extremely moment-based, local-based, not to negate all of our movements and ACLU and Saving Pandas and all those things that we want to do, but certainly to at least match that with a moment-to-moment participation, you know, in a real way, an embodied embodied appreciation and processing of what's going on all around you at all times, which is sometimes a thing that over-solutioning can short-circuit and prevent us from engaging in. Okay, so with that, maybe Josh or Luke, you're going to be leading me through this. Bring the first idea or question from our community.
So we're going to kick off, as we often do, with a question from Brynna. And they ask, how do we address what they're calling ecosystem blindness? They explain, I've spent the last 5 years working on my yard on restoring the native ecosystem and doing that by using indigenous practices. It's really rewarding work, but I'm the only person for several blocks doing it. I've decided to install a sign that says, native plants live here. And the neighbors have started to ask questions when they walk by, which is great, but here's where I'm starting to hit a wall. People think of plants as separate entities. I have this California lilac that's in full bloom right now. It looks and smells amazing. It's covered in bees. Two people have asked me so far if it's easy to grow, and I don't know how to answer that. I could say it doesn't require any water or fertilizer. All I have to do is prune it once a year. But the truth is, it's a plant that will die without a strong mycorrhizal network. My first three attempts failed because there wasn't enough of a diverse group of little native weeds growing around it to trap the moisture for symbiotic fungus. And people don't want to plant those weeds. They only want, showy things. I've tried to explain the complex stuff and how emotionally rewarding it is, but people start looking at me like I'm the neighborhood hedge witch. I mean, I know I am, but that's not the point. Even the native plant groups I belong to seem to follow this individualistic, only the pretty plants Western way of gardening. They label my lilacs as finicky and call it a day. So how do we shift the terrain, perhaps there's a pun intended there, on the way of thinking about these plants?
It's funny. I'm thinking about, this shows my background, the Tom Stoppard play Arcadia comes to mind. But let me first, the phrase you used was native plants live here. And I wonder if in order to communicate what you're doing, if you need to say something like, this is a native plant system, right? Because it's not native plants, plural. It's like, this is a system in itself. You know, this is not a lilac, right? This is not a blue lilac. This is the purple part of, you know, the temporary purple part of this collaborative organism.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
It's interesting. And I'm thinking, you know, in my front yard, there's a, I started to get this weird little purple, like weed. It was a green weed, and I'm watching it grow. And then these flowers came up on the top, and I'm like, whoa, look at this. And like a lot of flowers. And I took a picture and sent it to, Suzanne, the baker who's been on our show before. And she said, oh, that's called a volunteer. I mean, and what it is like a wild flower that just volunteers to be part of your garden. I just love the term. Of course, I saw volunteer. I went, oh, is that a kind of flower? It's whatever. She said, no, it just showed up, you know, because I guess the garden, what passes for a garden that I have is friendly enough for this other thing to come. And, you know, and rather than weed it out, it's like, oh no, it's the prettiest thing we got, you know, it's the best. And it just showed up. And I guess, cause it's making me think it's very related to the, what I was talking about in the introduction, that in Arcadia, the Tom Stoppard play, they have this big discussion between the difference. It was like the moment in history when they were changing from the symmetrical English garden to the more natural kind of chaotic style of garden that they called picturesque, the picturesque style, which I guess in English terms was equally fake, because what they're doing is, you know, we're going to create something that looks more natural rather than create something that looks very man-made, but the natural looking one was actually just, you know, symbolic of the chaos of the real. It wasn't the actual thing, but at least it was a step, you know, at least people started to understand that this, you know, dominating view of nature is not nature. But gosh, indigeneity, in it seems like a big duh, right? That of course we should be using indigenous, not just indigenous gardening techniques, but the indigenous native plants, rather than working against nature and trying to make your soil more acidic, more of this, less of this. It's like, well, what just lives here? And then can't we just have that? Like everybody in my neighborhood, they're all fighting to get the clover off their lawns. They have this special poison to get rid of the clover. And it's like, wait a minute, clover's really good for everything. It's like clover's fine, and the bees like clover, and they'll eat it, and they'll make honey. It's pollinating. It's, why not have clover instead of lawns? And it's like, oh, because the lawn, it's a lot of reasons. I mean, first, a lawn is more expensive, right? A lawn is more expensive to run. So the most expensive possible garden is going to be the one that's favored under capitalism. You know, it's interesting. You could solve everything with a little thing like this. So then if people start doing indigenous lawns or native plant lawns, maybe it's going to require a little bit more human intervention. Now you're going to be doing things or watering by hand or digging little things. And it's like, oh, so then there's labor. So now you get to hire people to actually do something instead of hiring a chemical company to poison the land. Now all these people who are being replaced by AI, maybe they'll have something to do and they could start saving the environment. I mean, it's like, it's interesting how quickly things can reverse, you know, that you're hiring humans instead of chemicals. But the impossibility of it, it kind of generates a little hope. You know, the way that so much is stacked against something as simple, including human attitudes, that is stacked against, oh, let me just have a native species lawn. I mean, you try to do that, neighbors are scared that you have weeds that are going to spread to them. It looks like dirt. It doesn't look like all the other lawns on the block. It undermines the premise of the suburbs, which was to create, you were supposed to believe that your house was like a manor house, that now you were some kind of royalty and you had this little kingdom and all that stuff and the lawn and the grasses like in England, which does, that stuff doesn't really grow so naturally here. So now you're undermining the idea of property ownership and home ownership. But the beauty of it is that something as simple as what you're doing, something as simple as creating a native system in place of a lawn, starts all these conversations. It has so many touch points, right? To capitalism, to homeownership, to our cooperation with each other, to climate change, to indigeneity, that it's a beautiful and real teaching tool. But the beauty of it, again, to my other point, is you're doing it in the moment. It's like, no, nothing wrong with giving money to the National Research Wildlife Fund and all, it's all good, but just doing it in the moment with your home, how much more effective is the communication, right? When someone's seeing it happening around them and then watching over a year or two how it becomes prettier than their lawn and more sustainable and you're not having to water this thing. And then all of a sudden, not all of a sudden, but over time, even the propagandistic effect of such a thing is takes effect. So, I mean, in answer to your question, it's slow. You kind of just do it and people see it working and people see it be happy. And I would say you just talk about it systemically and maybe the language on your sign, you can somehow indicate more. So it doesn't look like plants plural, but here's a native ecosystem. You know, so they understand that this is, it's a whole thing. This is a living organ. This is more like a coral reef than it is a piece of plankton. And boy, I mean, I want to see pictures. So post pictures in the Team Human Discord so we can see this thing. Because that's, you know, what I want to do. But boy, you'll see. Yeah, if anybody tries to do this, neighbors complain about stuff like this. They say, oh, it's an eyesore. Oh, no, they've got dirt and rocks. And like, no. This is a system. This is going to be cool. And it's a courageous conversation to have. But yeah, you do something like that in real time and it forces all the other stuff. But those, I think, are the high leverage points that we as individuals really can, and we as community members can undertake that are just so super, super effective. They're such high leverage points for system change because they're systems, right? For their systems, the more systems you bring in, whether it's from your gut biome to your front yard, the more systems you can engender and support, the more systemic I think we'll become as a species and civilization. So So thanks for that, Brenna, as always. What else we got?
Yes. Next up, we have longtime teammate, Content Carrier, asking, hey. I was fortunate enough to visit Korea for a press trip last week. We went to visit a factory where people make forklifts. The trip was organized by a Korean conglomerate called Doosan, which owns the American brand Bobcat. The Koreans have recently chosen to rebrand their existing forklifts to Bobcat for the international market. As of this year, these vehicles are being produced in the Bobcat colors, making it a new product line for the American equipment manufacturer, made in Korea, mind you. It made me wonder who came up with the idea. Was it the Asian owners or the American brand itself? Probably a bit of both. A general question for you. Would you say we are playing together, the West and the East, or are we still worlds apart?
Well, it's an interesting story. I mean, there's a lot of different, Easts, right? I mean, Asia and the East are, it depends, right? You've got South Korea, North Korea, and Vietnam. In those places, you've got the spectrum of China, from China through Hong Kong and Taiwan to the Uyghurs. Then you've got India and Burma and Nepal and that whole region. You've got Japan. You know, Japan would be the one that we're in a different conversation with Japan than any of the others. Maybe Japan and South Korea, but we've been playing cultural ping pong with them, more with Japan, I think, because of our World War II, which bonded us. I mean, it bonded us kind of in the way when you see two boxers or wrestlers kind of hug each other after a big fight. I mean, kind of, I think we're the amount of destruction we did to Japan at the end of that war kind of bonded us for life. But that conversation was, that's a very different conversation, right? Our conversation with Japan between, video games or the way Disney got interpreted by anime, and then anime got interpreted by Star Wars, which also interpreted Kurosawa, and the way that their video was involved in our early rave movement, you know, that back and forth conversation that Sony designed the PowerBook 100, you know, one of the first Apple laptops, you know, that there's been a cultural conversation with Japan or with, you know, the South Korean music and K-pop. And there's a conversation that's very different than, say, our conversation with Communist China about over-resource competition globally, or who's going to dominate in Africa or South America or in Southeast Asia. So it's hard to look at it, you know, as one thing. Even that, even us with China sort of shifted from them being our primary outsourced manufacturing labor force, which is now apparently Mexico has replaced China, even as America's or the United States' primary trading partner or cheap labor partner. So it's it's really hard. It's hard to generalize that. I mean, they're the in terms of the example that you bring up, I don't even think of them as national conversation so much as international conglomerates making deals about different things. So you want to take the same product and paint it green instead of yellow so that it sells in America or looks like an American brand so they don't think it's Hyundai or something, is kind of it's almost a post-national conversation that's more just market segments or consumer segments. But there's kind of a bigger conversation. It's a friend of mine. He's an interesting guy. I mean, your mileage will vary. But there's a guy that I've known for a whole lot of years named Mark Stallman, who's a largely self-taught media theorist who knows a lot about McLuhan and Norbert Wiener and a lot of these folks. He's been thinking for a long time about what he considers the three-body problem of the East, the West, and digital. And while sometimes I feel like it's oversimplified because there's a lot of things going on in the world besides the East and the West and digital. There's the global South. There's all these other people. There's, you know, women and men and textual. There's, you know, but in this sort of model of power in the modern world, he sees, you know, the East as a civilization that was developed with a pictographic language system. The West is a system, a civilization that was developed on an alphabetic language system, and now digital is emerging as this third force, and that you can understand a lot of geopolitics and a lot of culture as different combinations of these three spheres. The digital sphere, which is sort of like, you know, Elon Musk is sort of the digital sphere, and the techno-solutionists and the effective altruists and all those folks, a lot of the cause and effect people I've been looking at. And then you've got the West, who's mostly us, and is you know, capitalism and democracy and certain kinds of repeatability and, you know, Western science and alphabetic logic. And then the East, which he, and again, it's maybe an oversimplification, but their brains and society were raised on a different linguistic and alphabetic system. So it was pictures. It ends up being more holistic, more ground, while we're more figure. And then how do these three things interact? So if you're really interested in that, I would take a look at his stuff at the Center for the Study of Digital Life. You do a search for that online. And he's got some really interesting things on East, West, and digital. And the thing that's most interesting to me is looking at the advent of digital and the way these different civilizations are now looking at it and thinking about it. And how is it, and the battle over, you know, who is going to own that. Even just, you know, the fact that all these chips are made in Taiwan, and Biden saying, oh, we've got to build chips here because if China takes Taiwan, then where are we going to get our chips from? Or NVIDIA, which does all the AI, is getting all its chips from the East. So what does that mean? Do they want to, you know, I don't see how any of this stuff works without cooperation between these different civilizations, because the digital technology we have is depending on stuff that is coming from a lot of different places at once. But it's an interesting axis, and one that right now is strange. You know, the United States-China relationship is strange. As someone who's teaching at a university, I see there's, you know, many efforts by China, the Chinese Communist Party, by the CPC, to get their students and representatives into our sociology and communications programs, which is interesting in a moment when we see, you know, China along with Russia destabilizing, you know, American politics and journalism through, you know, various forms of disinformation, that they want to come to our communication programs to learn more about how we communicate, and our sociology programs to learn more about American society is a little, it's of concern, right? There's a lot of money coming into a lot of our universities from China, and money that a school like ours can't turn down. But sometimes I wonder, what's really going on here? You know, and I've had students yanked, you know, by the Chinese government because they've written a paper that was too controversial for the country they came from. It's like, this is a little concerning, but not that we're not doing not exactly the same things, but we're moving in a similarly sketchy direction. So I don't know. I'm concerned that I don't like America thinking of itself, or the U.S. thinking of itself, so much as a country over here versus those countries over there. It feels like there's a hunger in America now to become, I mean, call it nationalism, to become more just a country. I mean, and I get it. We don't want to be an empire. Britain did that. It really doesn't work. But when we retreat to something much more like nationalism, I'm just concerned for us to descend into a world order that looks more like, you know, the New York, New Jersey mafia of the 1970s than a European Union, say, but we're actually trying to engage with each other. And I think the more other and foreign and scary the East feels to Americans, the more we're going to want to retreat into that and compete with them in that way. That's like, okay, you guys take Taiwan, Russia, you can have Ukraine, Israel, you can have Gaza, and then we get Greenland. Okay, I mean, like you know what I mean, like Godfather territories. And I don't like that as a future. So, in terms of the East-West thing, what that brings up for me is how do we engender and support a kind of internationalism without triggering the kind of the MAGA paranoia of globalists coming to ruin what we have. So it's tricky. But yeah, it's an interesting conversation. There's just so many different ones, so many different countries. You know, you could do the American Vietnam conversation and analyze it in movies from 1960 to now and compare that with where American clothing manufacturers have, you know, offshored their cloth manufacturer. And I'm sure you could get a great dissertation out of that. There's so many specific ways of playing the East-West conversation that I couldn't, you know, generalize any one of them. But it's fascinating stuff to think about.
So Pat Mobley asks, I'm curious about the Team Human take on disability and disabled humans. Given that disability is a socially defined term by which they mean created by humans in capitalism, it seems like we could almost entirely eliminate the concept by redefining able away from capable of working.
Well, yeah. It's interesting because, you know, disability, I guess, has its legal definition in the U.S. If you can get an official disability, then you get Social Security money, right? So then you don't have to work. So you seek the classification so that you get money. And it's odd, right? That you need, I guess, that you need the classification in order to get the aid, because we don't believe you if you just need it for some other reason. You got to get an official, like, it's like you got to get a diagnosis code to get reimbursed by your insurance company. It's like, I'm just sick and the doctor gave me something. Yeah, but you don't have your thing, right? So you've got to almost institutionalize your disability. But yeah, I hear you though. The team human, you know, the mechanics of getting insurance or Social Security or Medicare in a bureaucratic state aside, yeah, Team Human, at least as I understand it, doesn't like people being measured in terms of their utility value. You know, that feels like that's capitalism, right? Oh, you are your utility value. That's why, oh, you've got to be scared of AI because they're going to replace your utility value and then you won't be able to get a job. It's like my ditch digging is my utility value or my strength or my this. So yeah, there's ability, disability, and utility value, which I guess Team Human wouldn't really care about because we value people intrinsically. But I would probably still look at ability and disability in terms of our ability to participate in community and society. You know, if there's a woman who can't walk to the town meeting, you know, she's entitled to a teenager to come over and drive her there or get her there or carry her there or whatever it is. So you acknowledge the incapacity to do something as an opportunity for a human being to go into service. I mean, it's so hard for people to realize that, but the The sign of a weak society is the lack of opportunities for people to engage in mutual aid, right? The lack of opportunities for people to do stuff. So every disability that someone has, I mean, imagine if that's how we thought, if we were so in the moment with problems that everyone who has a problem is like, oh, here's a chance for me to engage. Here's a chance for me to be present, not even solve, but participate with that. You know, and that's again, that's a different society. So the way I would look at so-called disability is more is what is this person's way of creating and exchanging value and energy with other people, you know? And one way that a person at a certain stage in their life may contribute value and energy to others is by creating opportunities for that person to learn and engage in mutual aid, for that person to do, you know, what we in Judaism call a mitzvah. You know, oh my gosh, look at this mitzvah opportunity. Oh my gosh, you know, and you know, I always tell the story about the woman in the vestibule up on the other street here on Main Street. It's this opportunity. It's like, oh gosh, she's there. I get to help her and her dog get out of this vestibule because it's easy. Well, it's actually not that easy, but it's, you just feel so good after it. So, it's tricky, but yeah, Team Human would not look at it in terms of their ability to do work. Their disability to work is so not their work in it to provide a utilitarian function is so not a measure of their ability to create value and opportunity for those around us. And that's it. It's redefining it. It's again, it's for me to redefine, you know, which is what I'm in the process of doing, redefine my own value less as how many problems can I solve for other people in my life than how many problems and challenges can I be truly present for? Can I really be there for? You know, it's the difference between an obstetrician and a doula in some cases, right? No, you're not going to do, I can't do a cesarean, but I'm going to really, really be here. And being able to distinguish that is, I don't know. It's a lesson I'm working to learn.
So John from Kentucky asks, let's say that we humans have successfully seized the present day's opportunity to wake up to the basic false promise of the latest, fastest, and most evident iterations of extractive, figure ground reversing manipulations of the masses via media, and have the ability to completely reorganize our ways of living based on what we've learned. What would be the best kinds of cultural safeguards to help future generations remember the lessons from the mistakes of their ancestors so as to not repeat them?
It's funny. I wrote a short story a long time ago about this, it's like the world was ending, and this scientist was charged with taking a message about how, like, you know, capitalism and selfishness and individuality, you know, fucked up our civilization. And he was gonna encode it into DNA so that when, and then they were going to take that DNA and like try to starseed it onto other planets so it would grow into, you know, into life and evolve into humans and do all that stuff. And when those human beings got to our stage and could do genetic engineering and all that and reach that potential crisis point, they would know how to read in the DNA and see his message, which said, you know, don't do all this bad stuff and whatever. So he's looking in the DNA then to see, where am I going to put this message? And when he finds this sort of perfect junk DNA area to insert the message, he sees a message in there, right? And it's from the last civilization, the same fucking message. It says, oh, don't do this, avoid this stuff. I'm sorry, but it made me think of that. You know, that's my little Black Mirror pitch, I guess. I gotta send it to them. Because one of those cute little reversals. But I mean, the mistakes of the ancestors, I mean, capitalism, we could say, you know, if we understand what capitalism and how it works and what it can be used for and why it can't become a mindset, you know, to see it as a tool, not as a way of life, as a temporary thing. It would be great. I guess capitalism came from this. This, I think human beings need maybe, it's kind of Tyson Yunka Porta logic here, I'm probably stealing, but that, I mean, human beings, as opposed to other animals and species, you know, we're a bit more self-conscious, I think, you know, than other life forms. We tend toward thinking about us as what am I and what do I care about? We're just a bit reflective, and that's really nice, but that self-consciousness also kind of tends to make us think of ourselves as separate from what else is going on. There's like me and everything else. There's humans and there's all these other forms of life, because we can do sort of more abstract thinking than other species, abstract about the future, abstract about the past, abstract about our relationships. We separate ourselves from everything else. And I think that's like a major safeguard we're going to have to, we would have to warn about, to really remind people, no, you are part of this thing, however much it seems like you're not, because I'm going to your figure ground statement, right? That figure and ground are related. We're not the figure and all the other species are the ground, right? We're not the subject and everything else is the object. That a much more sort of yin-yangy, getting back to our Eastern sensibility, a yin-yangy understanding that the figure is the ground and the ground is the figure, and we're all, you know, connected to this thing. And then maybe to be careful, at least my warning to myself, be careful about solving problems. Right, solving things. You know, the final solution is the next group's problem, right? So the problems sometimes are not to be solved. Problems are sometimes, I'm not saying be passive, but problems are sometimes things to adjust to, right? The clover on your ground, the indigenous native plant that's popped up is not a problem. It's a visitor. It's a volunteer, right? If you see it as a volunteer rather than as a weed, all of a sudden you go, oh, what's my lawn trying to do, right? What's my lawn trying to do? And how can I be there for that rather than trying to put my picture of a lawn, which came from some picture out of a book of a lawn in England, right? That picture, how do I get that and actually participate with what is there? So that'd be my start. It's really to help people realize they're not separate, and that solving problems sometimes involves our ability to have compassion and adaptation rather than constantly, you know, reconfiguring reality around our what we think is our need at that particular moment.
So thank you to everyone who pre-submitted questions. Our last two questions come from the live chat. And the first is from Joe Filmmaker, who asks, the alignment problem has been talked about quite a bit recently in relation to artificial intelligence. But this idea, it's been around for much longer with respect to corporations. Do you have any thoughts about addressing it?
I'm not exactly sure what we mean by alignment.
I think Douglas, he's asking about making sure AI is aligned with human priorities.
For AI to be aligned with human priorities, I feel like the people making AI would have to be aligned with human priorities. And the people making AI now are aligned with what we might call post-human priorities. They're very beautifully very futuristic. They're looking at the human civilization 1,000 years from now, and very concerned in a beautiful way about potential cataclysmic events that AI could cause. You know, once AI is totally in charge of everything and it's conscious as humans or smarter than us, but they're not. They have this, the problem I have of looking too far in the future and trying to solve things and fix things. They have it way worse than I do. So it's really hard for them. It's hard for them to align with human and natural priorities in real time. So I would say the alignment. The alignment would begin with, where are we sourcing the cobalt for the chips or the processors of the AI? Who are we hiring to tag the information for the AI? And how are those people being treated? You know, how are we taking care of the people whose data and creative output we are using to train the AI? And, you know, so all of those, the way in which you do the thing is going to impact the what that thing is. It's going to impact the way that AI functions across the board, right? Is it paying for the data? Is it paying for the creativity? And make the AI aware. Where's its resources coming from? How is this? And why does that matter? You know, so that the more of its own processes the AI takes over, the more of our values it's going to be using and deploying in successive iterations. And the values that are going into the development cycle of AI now are not values that I would want my children using. They're not values that I would want my AI using either. So again, it goes back to the same thing I was talking about before. Make AI in a way that is consistent, that has alignment, and the AI is going to stand a whole lot more chance of functioning with alignment in the future.
All right. Up next, Omdev asks, Doug, you used to be quite a strong advocate on local money. But about a year ago, I think you and others declared it more or less a lost cause. Was that a global view or just in the USA?
Oh, I don't know if I see it as a lost cause. I think local money, it just seems to be something that we're only going to use when central currency becomes too expensive. When it becomes, right now, central currency is, and partly because of they pumped so much in, it's serving a couple of different purposes. I mean, it's still pretty plentiful, so it's not. I don't know if people want to give Biden too much credit or Paulson or whoever, but, you know, people do have more spendable money now. They have on the whole in America now than they did a few years ago. As it gets harder, as the money supply diminishes or gets as it pools in, ridiculous, you know, Goldman Sachs funds, and things become unattainable again, then people are more willing to engage. But I guess, you know, the local currencies, I still love the idea. It's just really hard to get traction with them. And I'm finding we're getting more traction with community and worker ownership of companies. It feels like the cooperative labor meme and the cooperative labor system is getting more traction. People are more able to understand and more willing. It seems to be an easier, there's an easier on-ramp. You know, there's a lot of boomer business owners whose kids don't want to take over the business are looking for a way to exit. And this idea of exiting to community or exiting to their workers is actually working. So we're seeing a lot of businesses then become worker-owned co-op, that the workers buy the business from the owner and then operate it as a community. And then the currency seems to matter a bit less, you know, because they didn't take investment. If you haven't taken investment, then you don't need to grow in the same way as a business that needs to pay back investors or shareholders. So when it's worker owned, you can pretty much just ride out inflation and use the currency that's already there. But, you know, so I guess the sort of attention has shifted toward that and toward public banking, which is also a way to get lower cost loans and cash into local businesses and to give them some advantage over giant corporations that get their money so much cheaper. And as long as we have those, it kind of doesn't matter which poker chip we use. But yeah, it's partly because it's been really hard. It's hard when you live in a country where your taxes have to be paid in US dollars and where so many businesses are going to require you to convert to it anyway. It's also that crypto took a lot of the wind out of our sails. You know, crypto, which was going to be just a blockchain way of kind of organizing and accounting for local currencies, became this end in itself. How do I bet on that blockchain? You know, it's sort of meta, like when you sell your business to the stock market, how do I sell this coin to the speculative market rather than use this coin to promote local economic activity? It kind of like... those speculative currencies kind of took the wind out of the sails of some of these local currency movements and favor banks and all those kinds of things. But I think that energy has moved elsewhere, but into places that ultimately will, I think, bring us to the same sorts of places. So I haven't given up certainly on local currency. It just doesn't seem like the again, it's a little down the road. It feels like, oh, this would be a great thing. But then you've got to get people to use your currency, which is a harder thing than giving people an opportunity to own their own businesses, to build an Uber that's owned by the drivers rather than, a new currency for riding cabs. So it's sort of that. But I'm seeing a lot even more promise in local and worker-owned businesses and economic institutions than I did in the days when we were talking more exclusively about time dollars and let systems and all those things.
Douglas, we're coming up on the half an hour here, but we have one short question from Bob Fish, which I think will be our last question, which is, when attempting to create a local community larger than one's neighborhood but smaller than one's region, are there any pitfalls that are apparent to you? Or what should one avoid when the community begins to spread?
Disease. The community begins to spread. It's interesting. I mean, I don't know how to make a community as such. I mean, it's like there's a local community, and then I understand what you're saying, that what happens as community scales up, even if it's not going to scale, like you're not talking about some giant regional thing, and it's not really a community, but as it moves from like your town to the three towns around you or the five towns, and as it, what do you... avoid? A few things. I mean, one is the colonizer mentality. You know, so you've got a pizzeria in one of these towns, and then, oh, look, now my community isn't just my town, but it's the three towns around me. You know, you want to not then want to be the pizzeria for all those towns if they've each got their own little pizzeria, you know? So it's like, one tendency to avoid is expansion of your domain, right? Which is very different than the expansion of your awareness. So it's like, oh, I'm the plumber for these folks. Oh, now I could be the plumber for those folks and build out my thing and hire more people. It's like, oh, no. It's not about the growth of your business. It's not about the growth of your ownership. It's not about the even the growth of your influence, but the enhancement of your connection, right? Of your ability to process, of your compassion, if you will. And as you got to think, what's the reason we're doing this? Which are the ways where if a larger group of us pool resources, we can enhance the lives of everybody here? And which are the ways of scaling up that are going to lead to elites and impoverished? You know, which are the ways? So how do you become not a part of the rentier class, but part of the participation class? And I think that's, you know, that's tricky, right? It's tricky, but it's, I think that's really it. It's also to promote, you know, cooperation between like businesses in neighboring towns rather than competition. There's going to be three pizzerias, three sushi places, three hardware stores. How can they start buying stuff together cooperatively, right? How can they become part of the same buying movement rather than, you know, in either trying one trying to dominate, the other. So I guess that's kind of the way I think about it. Even schools, you know, how can we share resources without necessarily combining into one big feeder school? How do we maintain the character of each little town and give people local autonomy over what they do? But we could all buy our chalk. I mean, no one uses chalk. Our dry erase markers, you know, together and then have it be less expensive. So it's looking at these forms of cooperation. But yeah, it's a good question. It's a good question because we're not talking about scaling up. You know, you don't scale up community, but like you said, you spread. You know, you spread connectivity, and it's also being aware that in many ways, if they are more distant, then they're more distant. You know, and that's okay. That not everyone has the same impact on everything everywhere, right? That there are differences and distances, and you can, you know, maybe not to be mean to anybody, but you can treat somebody two towns away differently than you treat somebody, you know, 2 feet away. And that's not exclusionary. That's just intimacy. And that's, you know, that's part of it. So cool. I mean, you're all far away, but you're close. It's a different kind of community. And I'm not worried about scaling, but I do want to make what we do available to more people. So we're going to see. So thanks for doing this. We'll have many discussions, I'm sure, in the Discord about what worked better and worse about doing it like this than having people come up on stage. And we will, as a community, make a choice about how to play in bigger spaces. And if not increase our utility value to the world, if not increase utility value, at least increase our value to one another. So thank you. And thank you all for being on Team Human. You honor me with your presence, give me purpose, and make me a smarter and nicer person. Team Human is produced by Joshua Chapdelaine and edited by Luke Robert Mason. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you've been on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.